Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 3rd of May. In just a moment, Professor Bob McChesney will be joining us, a frequent guest here on the Ideas Network, and we'll be talking about all things media this hour of the program. The FCC has had some interesting hearings in Tampa, and this issue of how many television stations, radio stations, or newspapers one company can own in a market is very large. Also, we'll look at how we get more diverse media ownership. We'll look at the number of corporations who just own tons of newspapers and radios, and does that significantly limit the number of voices that you hear? They've also been calling. They issued a report last week on violent television programming and its impact on children. There have been some calls that they extend content regulation to cable television and also satellite channels for the first time. What do you think about that? We'll be looking at hip-hop music and whether or not certain language and ideas need to be regulated by the government as well. So all of that's coming up with Bob McChesney, and that will be in just a moment. We are in what we hope will be an extremely brief pledge drive. Rhonda Fanning, our producer, is joining me in our studio to give the phone number, and then we're going to go to Bob pretty shortly. We'll tell you about the goal. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi, Kathleen. 800-383-9772, just to get that phone number out there, or you can log on to WPR.org. We have $3,000 to raise this hour and towards our overall goal of $275,000.
And we want to just reach this as fast as we can. So we would recommend, if you want this baby over with, just call as soon as you can.
Get back to regular programming.
Which is right now. Make that call. Make that pledge. We have a goal. We have to reach $238,000. $965, and as soon as we reach that, it's over. So please call with your pledge.
800-383-9772 or log on to WPR.org.
Thank you, Rhonda. We'll talk to you a little bit later this hour. Robert McChesney is with us now, research professor of communications and professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's also the founder of the Free Press, a national media reform organization. He hosts a Media Matters radio program. He taught for many years on the journalism and mass communication faculty at UW-Madison, and his work concentrates on the history and the political economy of communication, emphasizing the role that media play in democratic and capitalist societies. He has written or edited 11 books, written tons of journal articles, newspaper pieces, magazine articles, and does a great deal of guest lecturing and radio and TV appearances. We outlined briefly, you can call in with other ideas too. We're just taking on the media this hour of the program. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Bob McChesney, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
My great pleasure, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Well, let's start with this hot issue that everybody loves to talk about, and that's the report last week on violent television programming and its impact on children. Is there too much of it? Does the federal government need to regulate this?
Well, you know, I think the starting point is understanding the federal government already does regulate it. It's a question of how it's going to regulate it, not whether it's going to regulate it. And I think, you know, my feeling about issues like violence and media content is the rational and enlightened regulation is one that creates a system that doesn't make it so rational to do violent programming, if that's something we don't want. And what we need to do is do research that links up the connection between the violent programming on television with concentrated media ownership, with commercialism and advertising, and see what the linkages are there. And if we see linkages there, then we put into place policies that have more diverse ownership, that lower the role of advertising and commercialism, on the principle that then you won't have to have the government actually involved in content regulation, but rather just make a system that makes it more rational to produce better content.
Yeah.
I think that's the sort of policymaking I'm interested in.
Well, it's interesting you said, what do we want? What do we want? How do we know what we want?
And well, that's what democracy is all about, answering that question. That's not something that sort of you're born with. That's something that comes through debate, study, deliberation, conversation. And I think as a society, we have to make those sort of decisions. What sort of media system do we want? What sort of content do we want? And then try to use our policymaking process to put into place a media system that promotes the values we're most interested in seeing promoted.
Mm-hmm. And is one of the reasons perhaps we're not getting that is because of consolidation of media, because we don't have diversity here, Bob?
Well, in the case of violent programming, I think that there is a clear linkage between concentrated ownership and between commercialism and between violence. I mean, the research that I've seen suggests that the violent programming comes significantly from the largest firms that have most market share, and that it, the more advertising-driven a medium is, the more likely it is to turn to violence. And why that is exactly is a broad question, but that is the conclusion you come to. Now, if that's the case, maybe we ought to be trying to look at a broadcasting system that has more diverse ownership, more local ownership, and more nonprofit, non-commercial, non-advertising-based sources.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't you think we need to know why it is that those people are turning toward violent programming? I hate that junk. I just hate it, and I don't understand why it's on the air. I don't understand why it's appealing to people.
Well, you know, that's a really complex question, and I'm loath to give a simplistic answer, but I will say that one part of the answer is simply this, that in our media environment where, you know, you have hundreds of channels competing for people's attention, albeit they're only owned by a handful of companies, what they've discovered is that certain types of programming are very easy to get people to stop there and watch. And violent programming has been a proven winner. Vulgar programming, too. It's inexpensive to do relatively, and it gets attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, if people are exposed to it over time, you develop a taste for it. And then you start wanting it because you've been exposed to so much of it. It's a rich, deep process. So it defies a simplistic answer.
Yeah. You know, this right after the Virginia Tech massacre, we had a psychiatrist with us, a very well-spoken, smart guy from New York, and he was talking about the manifesto, the killer, and the media putting that on the air, and he was just appalled by it, mostly because he said that there are people out there, you know, who are pretty fragile mentally, and this is just going to feed into their feelings of getting noticed by doing this kind of act. He really thought that there was a very direct link between this kind of stuff and people becoming violent. And he also said, if I were you, I'd call the networks right now and say, get rid of this violent stuff on television. We do not need it in our society, and it is creating problems. He was very, very clear about that.
Well, I think that's a pretty important position to make, and I think I can understand the basis of it. To the extent there's evidence that people like this Virginia Tech killer, their motivation is this sort of publicity, then giving that publicity may indeed encourage other lunatics to do similar stuff.
Right. That's certainly what he was saying. What's going on? I'm a little bit confused here. What's going on with media ownership now? What did the FCC rule on this? Are they reexamining the number of places that you can own, facilities you can own in a market, or you can own nationally, or what is it? What's going on?
Well, it's a very interesting period because by law, passed in 1996, the Telecommunications Act, the Federal Communications Commission is supposed to review media ownership rules every 2 years, with an eye to changing them if market conditions have changed in the country. And the most famous recent example of this was in 2003 when the FCC, under Michael Powell and the Republican majority, voted to completely relax media ownership rules in the country. And as I'm sure you recall, because we covered it on Wisconsin Public Radio, that effort met a massive public uprising right and left across the country, 3 million people opposing it at the FCC and later in Congress. And eventually those rules changes were thrown out by the courts. And the courts ruled that the FCC had acted improperly by not listening to the public at all, as they were required to by law, in making these changes in media ownership. Basically, they'd only listened to the big lobbyists for the companies that wanted to be able to gobble up more media. And now the FCC is required again to revisit its media ownership rules, but this time they've made a formal commitment to hold 6 public hearings so they can say they've gotten public input this time and that they're going to pay attention to it. And we just completed the 4th of the 6 in Tampa, Florida, just this week on Monday. And we've had 4 of these now, and at each of the 4 hearings, Los Angeles was one, there was one in North Carolina and one in Pennsylvania. At each of these hearings, the public has risen up and just demonstrated in hundreds, even a couple of thousand people at one of them, that they're very concerned about the lack of local ownership. They're deeply concerned about the lack of local content in their media, and they don't want ownership rules that are going to allow for more consolidation and less accountability from owners. So the message the SEC is getting at these public hearings couldn't be more emphatic, that people don't like concentrated ownership. And we'll see what's going to happen with the the new chair of the FCC, Kevin Martin, who's Michael Pollan's replacement, he's like Michael Pollan, is very much a proponent of the Bush administration's agenda, which is to allow media firms to own as much media as they possibly want. But he's really hamstrung now by the courts and by the fact that public opinion doesn't support him. Mm-hmm. And finally, he's hamstrung by the fact that with the 2006 elections, there are now Democratic majorities in both House and Senate. And there's no way any major change in media ownership rules will get through.
Interesting.
They'll be rejected by Congress. So it's really sort of in a phony war period. It's unclear where it's going to go. But I think the chances we're going to see major changes in media ownership rules before 2009 are extremely unlikely.
How significant, Bob, is the lack of local content around the country?
I think it's one of the great crises in our media today.
Really?
I think the decline in local journalism is one of the great stories, not just on radio and TV, but also in print. But in combination, I think the empirical evidence suggests there are far fewer journalists in most communities actually covering their communities than there were a generation ago. I think the evidence of concentrated ownership is that the first dream of a company when it can buy up the newspaper, radio, and TV stations and cable systems in the same community is to have one newsroom serve the entire community. And then what the community loses because it's only got one newsroom instead of four or five competing newsrooms, that's not a healthy thing for journalism. So I think the lack of local content in news and in coverage of communities is one of the pressing crises of our media system.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in some of this testimony from African-American gentleman who owned some radio stations and was quite successful in the Tampa hearings. He was saying that as a result of the consolidation and homogenization, there are two view voices in the market right now, and it's very, very hard. It was always one of my dreams to have a small radio station somewhere, you know, and program this real eclectic, eccentric programming. It that seems to be out of reach right now, but he was talking to that it's just incredibly difficult for people who want to bring diversity to the air to be able to do this right now.
It's a real scandal. I'll give you one example. It's the classic example, but this story is true across the country. In the early 1970s in Washington, D.C., there were nearly two dozen full-time radio journalists just covering the District of Columbia, not Capitol Hill and federal politics, but the community of Washington, D.C. Today, I think there are zero radio journalists
in
Washington, D.C. I mean, that's an extreme case to some extent, but it's really pretty similar. And we see that in print as well, the decline in the number of journalists covering communities. It's a major problem. And what we've learned in the last decade is that this problem is not going to be solved by the market. The market basically has said journalism is a non-starter for trying to maximize profit. And it's not going to be solved by magical technologies. As great as the Internet has been in many respects for our communication system and for our journalism, it does not wave a magic wand that creates well-paid journalists covering communities.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Let's welcome phone calls for Bob McChesney, our guest, research professor of communications and professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, founder of Free Press, a national media reform organization. He hosts the Media Matters radio program. He teaches at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and joins us frequently to talk about many issues in media, and there are many right now. We're looking at consolidation, changes to media ownership rules. We're looking at violence, violent programming. I do want to talk with him a little bit about music, because the Don Imus thing certainly sparked a discussion about hip-hop and how hip-hop portrays women and whether or not there is language that should be regulated in lyrics and songs, that the government should regulate that as well, not only for the words that are used, but for the content. And we have to ask him about Don Imus, and we have to talk to him about the post office, and we got a lot to talk about. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. A brief reminder, we're in a pledge drive we hope will be as short as possible, so call and pledge. Help us reach a $3,000 goal this hour, 800-383-9772 is that number, or go online at WPR.org. To your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You know, and this is your chance to talk about what you listen to and what you hear. Do you think that there should be regulations when it comes to violent programming? Do you believe that we need significant changes in ownership rules for media? How do we get more diverse voices on the air? Why is it that local news coverage is really in crisis, as our guest says? And I believe that he he's right. There's been a decline in local journalism. Well, take it on. We'll be with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Professor Robert McChesney, and our phone number again is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. John from Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
I was calling in about government censorship or the government controls on television or even actually for lyrics for rap music. I'm not a big proponent of government censorship, and one of the reasons is because it usually doesn't reflect my sensibilities. And then number two, sometimes it can be used as a political tool to punish the media for political reasons.
Mm.
And so I am not in favor of it, but I see there's a tremendous opportunity right now for a tool building what I would want as a parent, but I'm not a parent, but I would like to see an intelligent television that I could pick out an independent censor that had nothing to do with the government that would then allow my TV to play whatever they put a thumbs up or thumbs down on. And then I would pick out a censor in the marketplace that reflected my own sensibilities. And I think that opportunity is there today. The way we would do it is all the government would have to do is we're switching over to digital media. And by switching over to digital television, you can embed inside every television program and every commercial that's shown a space for a serial number. Make the serial number voluntary, and then have the government issue the serial numbers. So a director or producer wouldn't have to put a serial number in. It would totally be voluntary. And then with wireless internet, you can build a smart TV, and you pick out maybe you're for Jewish Mothers Against Drunk Drivers or OnwardChristianSoldiers.com, and you would tell your TV who you wanted your independent, market-driven censor to be. And then what would happen is your TV would be able to identify what's on the screen, and then it would ask the censor of your choice whether a thumbs up or thumbs down would allow that to be played in your home. That would eliminate the politics. It would keep my child, when I'm not home, from being able to watch stuff that I didn't want them to watch. And it would also allow me to pick a censor that reflected my own sensibilities.
Right. Bob, what do you think?
Well, I agree with John about government censorship. That's why I've always thought that enlightened policymaking is trying to help establish a system where it's not so rational to produce violent and misogynist content. And I think, you know, we have to. That's why we have to look at the structure of our system to see if concentrated ownership, profit motivation, and hyper-commercialism are producing more of this than we like, and then take steps to try to create a media system that makes it more rational to produce better content. As for the idea of having a sophisticated system that allows parents and users to censor out or avoid the channels they don't want and to encourage the channels they want, I think that is going to come, and I think that's fine, but I don't think that's the solution because that won't create good content necessarily. I mean, that's part of the solution at best, I should put it that way. You know, I think as a society, we've got to come up with ways to generate high-quality content that we want and that we need. I think it goes back to the question, say, for example, of local journalism. Being able to cut out gangster rap videos or violent shows is fine and good, and it'll be fine for certain families, but that's not going to increase coverage of whether there's going to be a toxic waste dump on the outside of town. That's not going to magically appear because we can censor out gangster rap.
Right. Thanks very much, John, for the call. I came across this statistic, which I found amazing, that we do have this V-chip thing to block channels, Bob, and evidently only 12% of parents do that. That's amazing, isn't it?
Well, you think it's amazing it's that high or that low?
Low.
Low?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm a parent, and I don't even know if I've ever been exposed to a chance to use the V-chip, so I didn't even know it was out there, to tell you the truth. So, I mean, I don't know how well they advertise it.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about more about the junk that's coming on the airwaves. A lot of this music, I'm sorry, it's just, you know, it hates women, it glorifies violence, it glorifies gangs. I'm just trying to get a handle on it because it's not good for us. It's not good for young people to hear it. It's really become, as you know, very much mainstream music among a lot of teenagers in this country. And I know it doesn't form exactly their view of reality, but to hear this kind of message of anti-woman, and it's just not good. And it seems to me as though somebody has to do something about it. People are making a lot of money out of this. It's got to be more than concentration of ownership and more than advertising. There has to be some way that we, as people, say we deserve better than this. We want music that you know, that is uplifting for us, not junk. So how do we get that, Bob?
Well, yeah, it's a great question, Kathleen. And I think I think the ownership and advertising issue is a bigger part of it than people understand.
Really,
and I don't think we should let owners and commercial interests off the hook. And, you know, there's been a really interesting debate on gangster rap and hip-hop and misogynist music in the African-American community and in the hip-hop community for two decades.
Yeah.
And oftentimes in the conventional mainstream news coverage, it's presented as if this is a monolithic community where everyone's marching around using derogatory terms about women. This is not so. In fact, there's a guy named Davey D, who's one of the leading figures in hip-hop, who's been involved since the beginning in the 1970s in the Bronx. And there's a huge community of hip-hop artists and rappers going back to the 80s who've been opposed to sort of this heavily commercialized, violent, misogynist stuff that sells. And, you know, it's been critical of the music industry, which has really been very inclined to pushing this and discouraging a lot of the sort of social criticism hip-hop that's out there by very talented artists, too. And I think, you know, their argument is that the stuff that's politically oriented, that criticizes, say, the current presidential administration or past ones, that the record companies are much more loath to do that for fear of antagonizing political figures than they are to put on something that attacks, you know, questions women's sexuality and degrades women.
Witness the Dixie Chicks, right?
Yeah, and I think that this is the real issue they're dealing with. And the way around that, you know, how do we solve that? If that is, in fact, the core of the issue that we're dealing with. Well, one of the things we try to do is policies, try to make it easier for these alternative types of music to be exposed to the public, get around the bottleneck of these four or five major companies that sell 80% of the music in the United States. And there are policies that do that. One of the great issues, and I think you might have alluded to it earlier, that's going on right now, is that there's an effort to raise the royalty rates that internet radio stations have to pay on music. It'll basically make it impossible for companies to use the internet to broadcast music, including, I might add, NPR stations, as you probably know, Kathleen.
Mm-hmm.
These rates go through. Well, a lot of these internet radio stations are a way to get around the bottlenecks of the Clear Channels and the big companies and play the standard playlist everywhere in the country and let new artists, different artists, not just in hip-hop, but across the music spectrum, have a voice and reach the public. But if we don't stop these onerous copyrights that they're going to put in to pay to play music on the air, much higher than broadcasters have to pay, I mean, understand, not the same rates, but much higher rates, it will make it commercially impossible for people to play music on the internet, to do internet radio broadcasting. And that's a fight that's going on right this second, and it will have a direct effect on what sort of music ultimately gets made and listened to and sort of culture we have.
Yeah. Doug from Madison, hi.
Good morning. I have just a couple of observations. One is about two depictions of violence that I've seen in movies, one from Siriana and the other was the new James Bond film, actually, that just made me squirm in my seat. And it just seems to me since 9/11, we've become a meaner and more hardened society all around. And it kind of shows up in other places, too. I know Bob used to work at a local community radio station here in Madison. And in the 1 o'clock time slot, they used to have a more diverse programming. But since 9/11, a faction got Democracy Now! Pushed through, so it's kind of become the community radio Goliath, stamping out some of that diversity. And I'll just take my comments off the air.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, on the issue of violence, I think there's a late but great communication scholar named George Gerbner, who worked at the University of Pennsylvania, who did a lot of research on this. And what he argued, and I think he demonstrated, is that over time, you know, if people have violent programming, they have to sort of ramp up the violence to keep giving people the same charge. So, you know, he did this classic study where he went through sort of, I think, the four or five Die Hard movies and noticed that in each one, the death count and the grisliness went up from the previous one. And his argument was that, you know, in a violent entertainment, that if you just keep it at the same level, basically, you know, there's a competitive rush to the bottom to make it more grisly to direct audiences, because people want more after they've gotten their fangs sharpened. And again, I think that, you know, not to keep harping on this, I don't think the solution is government content regulation. I think that gets us to places not many people really are comfortable going, and I'm certainly not comfortable going there. But we have to understand there are policy measures that do exist that actually help create the system that we can take to try to make our system do better work without content regulation.
Yeah. I have to ask you, because we haven't talked since Don Imus was fired. I'm interested in your thoughts on that firing, Bob.
Well, you know, I think the thing that struck me about that issue was that people were saying Don Imus's free speech rights were being abridged, and it was really unfair to Don Imus. And I think that people, I think there was a real confusion in our society between freedom of the speech and freedom of the press. Don Imus still has his freedom of speech rights. He's welcome to crack jokes on a street corner. He can write a letter to the editor. He can call into the show and tell his racial humor if he thinks he wants to do that. No one can stop him. He's not. No one's arrested him. He's not in the jail. The issue wasn't whether Don Imus is entitled to a job there. He's no more entitled to a job at a medium than you are or I am. I mean, or an American Nazi Party can't march into CBS Radio and say, give us a talk show or you're violating our First Amendment free speech rights. The real issue with Don Imus is freedom of the press rights, and the power of freedom of the press there in our system rests with the medium. You know, it rests with, they're the ones who are responsible for what's done, whether it's the radio station or the TV station. And they were fully within their rights to make their judgment for whatever reason that Don Imus shouldn't be on the air. And they did it as a commercial calculation. These are commercial institutions. And they just figured that what this guy was bringing was going to cost them ultimately money. And it wasn't worth the hassle.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't think it was a First Amendment issue. Now, people complain to MSNBC and CBS Radio and say, hey, we want Imus back. We want someone who represents his type of humor back. That's fair enough. But it wasn't like the government went in and fired Don Imus. His free speech rights were not abridged.
Yeah. What about the influence? And I'm wondering how large this was. We heard, and I thought it was an interesting change in terms of the makeup of corporate places like MSNBC or CBS, that you're finding more diversity. And it sounded to me as though the employees, many of them, were very concerned about this. This wasn't what they stood for, and that their voices were heard here. And we haven't reached a point where we're extremely diverse, but we certainly are more diverse. Did that play a role in all of this, do you think, Bob?
I think it's exaggerated considerably. I think if Don Imus was still, I mean, these companies are doing lots of things that the employees don't like, and the employees have no say in it whatsoever. I think basically if Don Imus would still be rolling in lots of money and not be stimulating bad publicity outside the company, these companies couldn't care less what their own workers thought. So I think that, if anything, that was just sort of like icing on the cake. I think the cake was public opinion and the concern that advertisers were going to jump ship and that this was going to create a crisis or scandal that might hurt them in Washington when they're trying to get their lucrative regulations passed in the future. And so I don't think it was – I wouldn't exaggerate – the actual role of employees. And it's worth noting that media firms, especially on-air and newsroom talent, in media firms is notoriously underrepresentative of the diversity of this country.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's very true. I thought it was interesting that the guy is now suing CBS. He wants the rest of his money, his $40 million contract. He doesn't want to be poor, right?
You know, one thing about the Imus thing that's worth adding, Kathleen, is that the thing that was striking about a lot of people remember, well, this is a shock jock story. This is Howard Stern.
Mm-hmm.
These guys make their living by sort of doing this locker room humor. And I've watched the Imus show, and that was not really his shtick. His shtick was bringing on presidential candidates.
Yeah, right.
Leading, you know, this was a serious talk show for politicians and leading journalists. And I think that what was so disgusting about this show and about these comments were that this sort of, to a lot of Americans, and it was this way for me, I think, it was sort of like you lifted off the veil behind the sort of men's club that runs the country.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it sort of said, this is what these guys, you know, they have their public relations firm telling us how much they love diversity, but get them alone at the bar,
yes,
and they're just basically
right.
A bunch of crackers.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good point. Back to phone calls for Bob. Let's go to Jim from West Allis. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Getting back to the issue of who can hold FCC licenses in various markets, I would also like to see restrictions put on not only how many licenses one can have within a certain area, but also who can hold a license. It really bothers me that when you have multi-faceted corporations like General Electric, for instance, holding these licenses, because they obviously have some conflicts of interest in terms of, you know, what other things that they do and what goes on their radio and television stations.
Well, Jim, you're absolutely right. I think this is precisely where the sort of corruption and laxity at the Federal Communications Commission and in Congress has to be challenged. I'm glad to say Free Press, the group I helped form that I'm on the board of, at freepress.net, is working exactly on these sorts of issues to make the law be enforced. There are actually laws in the books that, if they were enforced, would force a lot of these companies to divest some of their ownership. I'll give you a great example going on right this second. With the proposed sale of the Tribune Company to Sam Zell, by law, he is required to divest his ownership of newspapers or television stations in markets like Los Angeles or New York, where he owns both a daily newspaper and a TV station. Those were sort of waivers that have been given to Tribune Company that expire if the Tribune Company sells the company. But he assumed, he said blatantly, look, I don't have to worry about that. You know, basically, we own all the politicians and regulators.
Oh, my gosh.
We can get right. We have nothing to worry about with the law. We can skip it. So we didn't even factor that in. Well, we've got to organize. Say, no, Sam Zell, if you're gonna, you have to obey the law like everyone else. And if you, you know, you're going to have to sell off those newspapers or the TV station. So we have diverse owners in those communities. You can't just assume you can get around the law because you're a rich guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Time for a couple more calls. Our lines have been busy, but they are open at the moment. We're talking about media this hour with Bob McChesney. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. John from Burlington, hi.
Hi. My comment is, you know, it seems everyone wants to attack the rap artists or the individuals that are you know, actually the artists, and this whole, you know, just pass, you know, NBC or whoever it is that's giving them the venue or, you know, backing them financially is kind of just off the hook. And I think there's this separation between, you know, corporate business and the man that runs, you know, not necessarily the man, but, you know, a person in their corporate world. And then you ask that same person, you know, if they endorse that as an individual at home, you know, is that okay? You know, well, no, I don't want my kids watching that. But at the same time, you know, they're feeding their children with that same money. And this idea that corporate America just seems to have lost its ethics, and it's just, you know, whatever makes me money, you know, it just seems, whether it's that or, you know, just every day you hear about corporations that are, you know, flying under the radar and bending rules or not abiding by rules that are not only, you know, laws, but good for you know, the general public, you know?
Bob?
Well, I think the comment's well taken, and I think that's a lot of why the media policy work that I do and that a lot of people are beginning to do in this country is predicated on the idea that it's not a healthy society that allows a handful of profit-motivated firms to dominate our culture and our journalism in the manner we do, because we see the results in a commercially drenched culture and in really, I think, a deteriorating, dilapidated journalism. And we really can't have a viable self-government in a healthy society in such a context. That's why the media reform movement is growing at an exponential rate.
And do you feel like you're winning it all, Bob?
You know, we do. It's extraordinary, especially in view of the context and the times. You know, it's not really the most hospitable climate in Washington, but we've had a number of victories. Most of the victories have been of the defensive nature. But, yeah, we've won time and time again. The lesson we've learned in the last 4 years is that when people learn about this issue and they learn that the media system isn't something natural like the Rocky Mountain Range, but rather it's something created by government policies and subsidies that sort of really established the system. And these policies and subsidies are made in people's name but without their informed consent. When people learn this, they say, well, that's for the birds.
Right.
You know,
right.
I want to get involved. I don't think it's right that one company should own all the media in my town. I don't like my children's brains being marinated in advertising. I don't like the fact there's no candidate coverage in the media except for political advertisements, except, ironically, or appropriately enough, since this is a pledge drive day, on public stations.
Yeah, exactly. A couple more phone calls for Bob in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. We're talking about media this hour of the program and a number of different issues related to media. He is a research professor of communications and professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at UW-Illinois University of Illinois. He used to be at UW-Madison, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's the founder of the Free Press, a national media reform organization, and speaks widely on all of these issues. So we have time for maybe one more phone call. If you want to join us, please grab it right now. And may I also say, we are in a pledge drive, and we just need to reach $237,950. We'd like for this pledge drive to be short, so please call and pledge as well and help us reach $3,000 this hour. Where else do you get these kinds of conversations? You certainly don't get them on mainstream media, because that's what we're talking about, is what's wrong with mainstream media. 800-383-9772. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's spend a few moments, Bob, before we have to pledge here, on an issue that's very important to you that is way under the radar. I'll bet 90% of the people listening don't know about this issue at all. Let me frame it in terms of Time Warner versus the U.S. Postal Service, or in cooperation with the U.S. Postal Service. What is that story?
This is a huge story, and I'm delighted you raised it, Kathleen. The magazines in this country, one of the largest expenses they face is the postal cost. It's the post office, or the postal service, is the distribution arm for magazines and periodicals and journals in this country. Traditionally, in American history, it's one of the greatest policies in American history. Going back to 1792 and the passage of the very first Post Office Act, the United States has subsidized the distribution of newspapers and magazines and periodicals to encourage a wide-ranging print culture, to encourage the spread of ideas. It was seen as an absolute necessary expense to build a free press, to have a free society. And it's been a hallmark of our media policymaking ever since. And it still remains in place today. So if you or I wanted to send a copy of Time Magazine by first class, it would cost us a lot more than it costs Time Warner to send Time Magazine through the post office. They pay a much lower rate.
Mm-hmm.
That's a subsidy. And I think it's a healthy subsidy. Well, what's happening right now is that the Postal Regulatory Commission came up with a new set of rates. They needed to raise money. And they had a proposal from the post office, or what's now called the Postal Service. They have an 11% across-the-board increase on all periodicals to help make up the budget shortfall. And all the publications, they're going to do the small ones, said, okay, fair enough, it's a lot of money, but we'll budget it.
Uh-huh.
But at the last second, this Postal Regulatory Commission instead rejected that proposal and adopted one that, as they said in their formal report, had been proposed by Time Warner, the largest magazine publisher in the country. The Time Warner proposal gave a lot of discounts to publishers that did all sorts of things in the way they prepared and dropped off their publications. But these were discounts that were largely best used by the very largest companies. The small guys really could take advantage because you had to have big numbers to make them work. The problem is they still had to come up with the same amount of revenue. So by giving discounts to the big guys, it meant the little guys' rates were going to have to go up so they could raise the money that was necessary. And this all went under the radar.
It sure did.
In March that it was approved. And finally, a bunch of small publications, and not even real small, like The Nation magazine or National Review, the conservative magazine, started doing the numbers and found out that their rate increases were going to be closer to 20% than 11%. And McGraw-Hill, the publishing company, did a comprehensive survey and found out there were a lot of small publications that were looking at rate increases immediately at 30% as a result. Now, this is a huge expense for magazines. This is literally enough to put a lot of magazines
out
of business.
Right.
And if it doesn't do that, it will at least force them to divert money from their quality of their product to pay the post office to get mailed. While at the same time, the big magazines connected with Time Warner look like they're going to be getting very low increases compared to the small publications.
So who's on this issue? Are you trying to get this changed? Is anybody taking up the cause?
Well, Free Press, along with a lot of the publications and a lot of public interest groups, are really trying to raise awareness of this. We've got an agreement or a commitment from Danny Davis, the representative from Illinois, to hold a hearing on this. He chairs the subcommittee that handles postal rates. We hope to have that soon. Right now, we're trying to just get people aware of it and to sign the letter sort of calling for an investigation to make sure we don't institute this policy before we really understand what the effects will be upon freedom of the press and upon small publications. One of the things that's really striking about this is not a left-right issue. Like most of our issues, these cut across the political spectrum. We're working with the National Review, American Conservative. All the publications understand that this sort of onerous increase is just disastrous for the whole realm of ideas and free press in our society.
Yeah. All right, just tell people why they should pledge, Bob. We got to make some money.
Well, you got to pledge because what you just heard, you won't hear on any other.
No, you won't. I was thinking you won't hear it anywhere.
You won't hear it
anywhere. I know. This is it.
You know, the issues that the Ideas Network covers, that Kathleen covers on this show, just aren't heard anywhere else on the radio dial. And the idea that callers can call in, like the callers we've had today, and can actually have 2 minutes uninterrupted to lay out a pretty sophisticated idea, like the guy with the V-chip plan.
Yes, yes.
You know, if he was calling a commercial network, he would have been shut up after like 15 seconds, told to wrap it up, and we would have gone to 3 minutes of commercials, come back, and then talking about J-Lo's butt. That is what, take the taste test, go down the dial, see what the alternatives are. If you want the stuff about that sort of stuff about J-Lo and yelling and screaming at each other and callers just having to say ditto to get on the air, well, you should be a happy camper. The world's built for you. But if you want stations like this, it requires people to step up to the plate and say, I really want this. I want to support it. I want to keep it on the air. I want to keep programming like this. And that means people at this moment have a real opportunity to demonstrate how they really feel about media in this country. A lot of the stuff I talk about takes big political campaigns. It takes signing petitions. It takes calling up politicians. Mm-hmm. This is something you don't have to call any politician. All you have to do is call Wisconsin Public Radio, make your pledge, make your payment, and then you can sit back and be completely relaxed knowing that you've participated in making a great radio station possible.
Oh, you're good, sir. You're good. Thank you. Thanks, Bob.
My great pleasure.
Bob McChesney talking about media with us, and it is a very short pledge drive. Our number is 800-486-86. Oh, no, that's the on-air number. I'm sorry. 800-383-9772 or WPR.org. Rhonda Fanning is joining me. We have a $3,000 goal. We want this baby over with as soon as possible, so call and pledge right now. I mean, I love the way he presented that. How can you not call and pledge? I know. There's nothing you can say that's better than what he had to say of why you should pledge.
800-383-9772 or log on to WPR.org. We have a couple minutes left. We are far from our goal.
We are far from our goal.
$2,400 of that $3,000 goal this hour. So pick up the phone, call 800-383-9772.
It only takes a second. As he said, then you can just sit back and feel good about yourself, feel good about the day, and know that you're contributing to a station. This is the only place you would hear an important conversation like this. It is the only place you would hear it. So call. We need some money. We need to, you know, we need your money. 800-383-9772 for your pledge. We're way far from our goal, and we want this pledge drive over as soon as possible. 800-383-9772. Bill Estes is joining us in our studios here in Milwaukee. Our manager. Oh, there goes some phone calls, Bill.
There we go. Excellent.
That sounds good.
I don't know if there's anything I can add or anything I can say better than Professor McChesney just did. I mean, he must have been reading one of our scripts. But he also has a passion for Wisconsin Public Radio and what we do here on the Ideas Networks, and he understands it. And we want you to be able to understand that and get the concept as well. If you'd like to see this caliber of programming and the caliber of the guests that Rhonda and Kathleen bring you every single day here on the Ideas Network, put a dollar amount on that, $150 a year, $250 a year. You decide the amount, but help pay for this programming service. 800-383-9772 is the number, and it's easily done. And as Kathleen said, take a minute of your time this morning and pledge your support to keep this programming coming your way.
And, you know, if you need an incentive, we got this 2-for-1 card. You can go to a lot of restaurants and get a deal on your dining experience. So if you need a motivation, that would be fine. The motivation you need, actually, is that we need your money. We need to make this pledge drive as short as possible so we can have full hour conversations, even though we still do most of that, even with a pledge drive. It's just important that we hear from you and meet our goals. Otherwise, this will go longer. 800-383-9772 or WPR.org.
I would like to thank some of the people who have already called and pledged this hour. Helen from Madison called, and she says that she thinks Kathleen Dunn is the best interviewer on WPR, mm-hmm. and she's especially interested in the media, so it was very fitting that she called this hour with Professor McChesney. that's just a sampling of some of the guests that we've had here, not just dealing with media. Amy Goodman has been on recently from Democracy Now. Sandra Van Oker, who is a veteran journalist.
Oh, what a great find he was. We saw him at a conference a while ago and said, Sandra Van Oker.
And he's been on twice since then.
He's great. We have to have him on again sometime soon.
But that's we also talk about media in the historical perspective. We had Hank Klibanoff on, and he talked about, he covered the civil rights movement in the South,
about
his book, The Race Beat. So all kinds of guests. Call now. Show your support, 800-383-9772, or you can log on to WPR.org.
And every pledge break is completed by getting a call from you, and then another listener, and another listener, and then we make the goal for this particular hour. And then by the end of the drive, whenever that comes, we will have made that $275,000 goal. So it's important that you call in right now and help pay for this great service that you've become, that you've come to rely on here on Wisconsin Public Radio. If you've never pledged before, that's mainly why we're here, to try to encourage new members or folks who've maybe let their membership lapse. We're going to ask your name, telephone number, we'll get your email address, we'll find out the amount you want to pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll ask, how do you want to pay for it? We're going to make this very easy on you. You can pay for it all at once. You can pay for it in quarterly installments or monthly installments. You can put it on a MasterCard or Visa or Discovery card and pay for it however you want, or we can set it up as an electronic funds transfer so you can have it come quietly and silently and painlessly out of your checking or savings account every month. You decide how you want it to happen, but first thing that has to happen is for you to go to your phone and talk to one of our volunteers. 800-383-9772.
We had somebody call and make a pledge who said he just discovered the station about 3 months ago, and I think in terms of, oh, you've all been listening for years and years
forever,
and years.
Never, never.
But no, and he's very interested in politics and got stuck on the station now because we do a lot of political. Tomorrow we're going to be talking. Tonight we all watch the Republicans do their debate. Tomorrow we talk about it together. It's fun. It's interesting. We're involved in being members of a democracy. But a lot of your life, you just discovered us perhaps, so you're new to us, but you want to say, I love what you're doing. Please call with your support. We're a ways from our $3,000 goal, and we just want to have you call, okay? Pledge, 800-383-9772 or WPR.org.
A lot of those new listeners probably found us through the internet, maybe. So log on, WPR.org. Just a couple of clicks, and you'll be on your way. You'll be supporting this great service that we have here in Wisconsin Public Radio. So please call 800-383-9772 or go to the computer and log on to WPR.org.
800-383-9772. We have about $1,000 to make the goal this hour to put us on track to end this pledge drive as soon as possible. As soon as we hit our goal of $275,000, it's done. And we are now at $236,000 to go. So if you've, again, as Kathleen said, if you've been listening for 3 months or 3 years, but you've never pledged, here's your opportunity. 800-383-9772. We know once you discover Wisconsin Public Radio, you fall in love with it. You appreciate the education and the lifelong learning, the great topics and guests, the insightful opinions that you get from authors and actors and politicians and all the folks that Kathleen and Rhonda bring you every single morning here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Put a dollar value on that. $10 a month, $20 a month. Make that call right now at 800-383-9772.
The conversations that you simply don't hear anywhere else. Now, this may seem like a minor issue, but when Bob McChesney talked about the U.S. Postal Service and how this increase in rates is going to affect all of these periodicals, this is a very large issue that has been completely overlooked by the press. I mean, it could affect, you know, conservative publications, liberal publications. It's a very, very big issue. You know, more power to him and, you know, pat on the back to us for bringing forward these kinds of issues, because you don't hear them anywhere else or be able to talk about them. You can tell we believe in what we do. Would you please call? We are listener supported, and you do support us, and so come through for us now and make this a pledge drive that's short and meaningful. 800-383-9772. 800-383-9772. Halfway toward our goal right now. So let's move along.
And only a few minutes left to get there. Public Radio is a partnership, and we need your support. When was the last time you were able to pick up the phone and talk to Gwen Ifill or Jimmy Carter, Alice Walker?
You're right.
Chances are it was right here on the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Nowhere else.
Ideas Network. That's right. So show us your support. Pick up those phones, 800-383-9772, or log on to WPR.org.
And you can get this if you need to be enticed, one of these cards that will allow you to go to restaurants two for
card.
One. Thank you. Membership card. You can go to restaurants all over the state, and that's a pretty good deal. And think
cultural
of us every time you go there. And cultural
museums,
activities.
2-for-1 entrance.
Yeah.
Only $120.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We forgot to tell people how much to give after all of this. $120. If you want to give more than that, that would be great, and we'll reach our goal even faster. 800-383-9772 or WPR.org. We're slowly getting there. Keep calling this hour. And I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, John Treader for on-air production, and thanks to Bob McChesney for being with us. Bill Estes, thank you. We have, 20 seconds, so whoever wants to make those phones ring.
800-383-9772 or log on to WPR.org.
That's it. Bill, tell them to call.
Thank you to all of you who called this morning, and thanks to all of you who are going to call in the next minute or so. 800-383-9772. We do appreciate every single pledge, be it $10 a month or $1,000. 1-800-383-9772.
News is up next, and we'll return. Thanks.